goodbye for the morning light. But don't let me be alone tonight. Say goodbye and say hello. You're not good to see you, but it's time to go. Don't say yes, but please don't say no. I don't want to be lonely tonight. Go away then, Daniel. Go on and do as you please, yeah. You ain't gonna see me getting down on my knees. I'm undecided and your heart's been divided. You've been turning my world upside down. Do me wrong, do me right now, baby. Go on and tell me lies, but hold me tight. Save your goodbyes for the morning light, but don't let me be lonely tonight. I don't want to be lonely tonight. No, no, I don't want to be lonely tonight.
Never been let alone. Make this whole damn thing work. Like a child, but she's always a woman to me. She can lead you to love, she can take you or leave you. She can ask for the truth, but she'll never believe. And she'll take what you give her as long as it's free. Yeah, she feels like a thief, but she's always a woman to me. She can wait if she wants. She's ahead of her time. Oh, and she never gives out. And she never gives in. She just changes her mind. And she'll promise you more than the Garden of Eden. And she'll carelessly cut you and laugh while you're bleeding. But she'll bring out the best and the worst you can be. Blame it all on yourself, 'cause she's always a woman to me.
suddenly cool. But she can do as she pleases, she's nobody's fool. And she can't be convicted, she's earned her degree. And the most she will do is throw shadows at you, but she's always a woman to me.
Words are like weapons, they wound. According to my list here, we have Richard Padilla, Steve Del Bianco, Carol Bird, Hope Melman, Carlos Alvarez, Maria Farrell, Patrick Kane, Eric, myself, and Glenn de Saint-Jury. Is anybody else on the line that I've omitted? Okay. Well, I sent out, and it wasn't until earlier today, for which I apologize, just a, kind of the skeleton of an agenda here. Basically, to recap, we asked for people to make submissions last week. We got a couple of submissions that addressed some or all of the questions about the OPOC's roles and responsibilities. And so I wanted to spend a little time today discussing those. I know there may be some additional submissions, and this doesn't foreclose that, but at least we could get started looking at the ones that we've got now. I did want to call everyone's attention to what I thought was a useful posting from Paul Stahura, who is, I guess, not on the call, but it was it helps to put our work in context with the OPOC proposal. And if you saw his May-must document, which I sent you again the link to, you see that you know, there's a lot of things that are already spelled out in the OPOC proposal. And then there's some things that are yet to be discussed. I happen to think that actually our there overlaps between item 11 and item 12, which in terms of what the responsibilities will be, because one of the responsibilities of the OPOC may be to be the gatekeeper to some of the information that is no long, would no longer be publicly available through Who Is. I thought that that document was pretty was a pretty useful tool for orienting us to where our discussion fits in the larger picture. I did also want to follow up on the you know, we spent some time last week. Ross Rader, who I think is not on the call today, raised a point about OPOC and also about the applicability of what we're talking about to the administrative and technical contact, and asked that we seek clarification about whether this is within the scope of our subgroup. I did pass, and then Ross made a posting on this, which I think was a little bit different than what he said on the call, but basically the same. I passed this along to Philip Shepard as the chair of the working group, and I understand that he has been in contact with Ross directly and to try to get some clarification on what Ross is asking for. I'm not sure to what extent we're just talking about the label for what we've been calling the OPOC and whether that person bears a different label such as administrative contact or not. I don't think that what Ross is suggesting certainly, I mean, certainly doesn't moot what we're talking about. It doesn't make what we're talking about irrelevant in any way. So I think we'll just wait for further clarification on that and move ahead with the assignment that we have. And if in fact our focus needs to shift a little bit because of Ross's concern, we can circle back and take that into account at that point. So I don't know if people have any questions about that or if there are other issues that they would like to bring up on our call today.
Steve Del Bianco, can I ask a question about Paul Stahura's document?
Sure.
That 11 and 12 are the areas we would focus on, since they're the ones where we discuss responsibility.
Yeah.
And in 11, I'm confused whether Paul is under 11A. It says, in this case, the registered name holder must accept liability for harm. But in which case is he speaking of? the case where there's a proxy ID, or the case where the registrant and the OPAC are the same?
I think he is talking about the case in which there is a proxy ID protect service, because that text in 11A is taken directly from the registrar accreditation agreement as it stands now, which says that if you license the domain name registration to somebody else, then you are liable for harm caused by wrongful use of the name unless you disclose the identity of the licensee.
All right. And in the case of that, is the status quo registrar agreement, speaking about a proxy, do we all want to view that as a parallel to OPAC, in the sense that a proxy registrant is effectively what an OPAC would be? And if so, doesn't that infer that liability is conferred on the OPAC?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one way to look at it. I mean, I want to back up on 11. He says the registrant contact and the OPAC may be the same contact information and may be the contact information of a proxy ID protect service the same as today. So he's not saying necessarily would be that, but that it could be that. I do think there is a lot of overlap between what we're talking about and the question of proxy services and what are their roles and responsibilities, because I think, as I said, he's taking in 11A the language directly from the registrar accreditation agreement, but I think that's very general language. Perhaps as if we are able to get
Adam Scoville, Johnny, thank you.
Perhaps if we're able to get more specific about these roles and responsibilities of the OPAC, we can flesh out more how that provision of the registrar accreditation agreement ought to be applied. But I what I take away from this may must document from item 11 is that there may well be a lot of overlap between the OPAC and the proxy service, but it's not necessarily.
Right, and overlap isn't the only question. Some of it is, if the status quo is the word must, if the status quo in the registrar accreditation agreement is that a proxy registrant must accept liability, then we are not plowing new earth in assuming that for the OPAC.
Excuse me, Ms. Carrie Muller joining. Thank you.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Are there other comments on this may-must document?
Hi, this is Bertrand LaChapelle. Sorry for joining late earlier. One question on the point 11. What I understand in the point 11 is that it means basically that the OPAC can be the registrant, but I'm wondering whether the formulation at the moment and the general thrust of the discussion is not moving away further and further from having the actual registrant name in the WHIS database, and moving the OPAC and the whole registration in the WHIS database more and more towards the general mechanism of proxy registration. Isn't that, in paragraph 11, a sort of shifting of focus, whereby instead of having a WHIS database about the registrant information, we now get the OPAC that may be the registrant information, but is more and more likely to become a sort of proxy in general terms?
Yeah, Bertrand, I'd be glad to respond to that. I think you raise a very good point there, because in what I read, the registrant contact may be the contact information of a proxy ID protect service, same as today. That is the status quo. An increasing number of registrations, if you go to WHOIS and you look at who is listed as the registrant, it's domains by proxy or it's an ID protect service of some kind. When that happens, then 11A is applicable. What we would think of as the registrant, the person is actually using the domain name, if you will, is a licensee of this registered name holder, and that licensee's identity has to be revealed when you provide the registered name holder with reasonable evidence of actionable harm.
But this is exactly the point I wanted to raise. I'm, once again, coming relatively late in this discussion. I'm seeing the whole debate about the OPOC moving in the direction of making a sort of default setting that people are using proxy or registration of domain names, whereas from the discussions I've heard in the various meetings in ICANN, I felt that the proxy registration and the privacy protection through proxy was not considered as a major improvement. And aren't we pushing in that direction?
Only if we can attach concrete responsibilities to this formerly known as proxy, now known as OPOC. We would only push in that direction, Bertrand, if we could attach with it responsibilities that matter.
Yeah, I mean, this is Steve Metallitz again. We can look at OPOC as kind of a universal proxy, if you will. Right now, someone has to opt in to getting a proxy service under OPOC. In a sense, everybody would have a proxy service. However, the OPOC proposal does still contemplate identifying the name of the registrant and the country of the registrant. And I think this is the point that Bertrand is raising. You know, if that's the name of a proxy service and the country of a proxy service, you know, what information really are we getting?
This is Steve. May I suggest this, that the prevalence of proxies today could be a function of the fact that they are cheap and it's seen as an easy thing to do. All right? So they don't charge a lot to be your to stand in place for you as a registrant and be your proxy, and they don't really charge much because they don't take on significant responsibilities. And if that's the case, we don't want to simply replicate that into the OPOC. But Paul Stoher's document suggests it may not be the case, that in fact a proxy registrant today under the RAA must accept liability for harm caused by wrongful use of the name. If that's the case, then the proxy guys are charging little today and doing little because they're really not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
This is Bertrand again. This is a helpful discussion. Does that mean that the thrust of the discussion, is particularly in this group A, is to say OPOC could be considered as a universal proxy service with responsibility, and registrant could still have the possibility to, of course, not use this, but put their own data about themselves that would still be protected in terms of privacy rules? But does that mean that somehow the fact that you put your coordinates becomes not the default, but somehow an option?
It is today.
Well, not really. I mean, you are supposed to put your coordinates, and if you want to use a proxy service, then the proxy service takes your place somehow.
And I think that's more prevalent than not today, wouldn't you say, Steve?
Yes, but isn't one of the reasons for people using this isn't the main reason the fear that some people have, rightfully or not, that their privacy data is going to be abused? If the system allows for your name and a few information to be accessible, but the main privacy data not to be accessible, would they still have a reason to use proxy service, and should this be encouraged?
Yeah, I think that's a good point that we should make sure to keep in mind here, which is, what is listed here in number 11 as a may, which is that the registrant can be listed as the proxy service, is that an option that should continue in the OPOC environment? Okay. Any other comments or questions on this may must document, or on, you know, these issues, the proxy service issues that Steve and Bertrand have raised?
Yeah, this is Eric Durker.
Okay, let me have a cue here. I heard Eric.
Yeah.
I heard Philip. Did somebody else want to get in the queue? Okay, let's, Eric, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I just think that we're barking up the wrong tree if we're going to start assessing liability to someone. Liability as to content of a website our conduct of webmaster, if we're going to assign that liability and say that the OPOC or the proxy is responsible for that, because that just turns that person into an overseer of that data, whether and I'm not talking about, it doesn't have to be pornographic data or something that's horribly illegal. It can be simply libel. Can't be slander, but it can be libel, so it's defamation. And how would they know, and how the cost then would be prohibitive. What we've done is we've created a very nice mechanism, but the common person can't afford it, because just to carry the insurance to handle that is phenomenal.
Steve, this is Adam Scoble. Can I get in the queue?
Yes. I think we have Philip and then Adam.
Thank you, Steve. Just a question really on proxies, and my apologies if this is covered. I wasn't on last week or at the very beginning of this call. Is there agreement that if proxies are to continue, then whatever rights and responsibilities relating to the OPOC would also apply to the proxy? And in fact, they'd be one and the same. It would merely be an option for the registrant to designate to one or the other, but the outcome, in fact, in terms of the work of this group would be the same, or is there debate on that issue?
Let me ask, we've got Adam in the queue. I'd be glad to try to respond to that, but Adam, why don't you
go? Why don't you go ahead and respond to that, and then I'll come back.
I don't think that's been discussed, Philip, and I think it raises the question of whether in the OPOC environment you could have the proxy service as the registrant and then the proxy service choosing an OPOC, and you'd basically be two steps removed from the, if you will, the real registrant, the person who is using the domain name. And I think I would certainly be concerned about that, but I don't think we've discussed it up to this point.
No, sure. I mean, the way I was assuming that, yes, there'd be a proxy contact in terms of making contact to the registrant, and that strikes me logically would be the same as the idea of the OPOC we're talking about. If indeed you've got proxies on top of proxies on top of proxies, it starts to make a nonsense of everything, yeah.
No, I think there certainly is a lot of overlap. Whether there would be identity or not, it may be another question.
Okay.
Adam?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond a little bit to Eric's point about the sort of the liability and whether the degree of responsibility that the OPOC's taking on would make it cost prohibitive. You know, I guess I would just say that more accurately reflects the costs that are involved in this enterprise, that these proxy services are often they have the nice benefit for some kinds of registrants of the privacy protection, but they externalize a lot of costs to others who it becomes much harder for them to enforce legitimate legal rights, whether that's a law enforcement or it's a private party. Those costs are there in the current system. They're just being externalized, and I think that to some degree all that this is saying is, you know, look, if you're going to make it impossible to find the real person, then, you know, I think it's a really basic principle that the OPOC or the proxy, really, if we can't get hold of the real registrant, we ought to be able to get a hold of someone who is functionally and legally equivalent to the registrant. That's a really simple principle. And, you know, if that's something that would generate enough liability that, you know, a lot of companies would hesitate to step into those shoes, then, yeah, then that suggests that the system is only viable if you are externalizing costs onto other people.
Agreed.
Exactly. If those services are being offered cheaply today, it's because the proxies are not bearing those costs.
Okay, is there anybody else wanted to be in the queue at this point, or shall we turn to the proposals that have been submitted?
I'd like to say two things. This is Carlos Alvarez.
Go ahead, Carlos.
Okay, first of all, I totally agree with the idea of having registrants having the option of including their own data to be published to the HUI service, or having them given the possibility of choosing a proxy service. If it's about protecting their data, they can be free to choose whether or not to protect it, and in that decision being something made by themselves. And second, besides what's just been said about the liability of those processes, I do believe that according to Paul Stahura's proposal on 11A, the proxy would not be liable unless it discloses the identity of the licensee. So both cases would be covered. Whether the proxy does not disclose in case it would be liable, or in the case it discloses the identity of the registrar itself, so it would translate that liability to that third party. So I agree, and I do think that proxies would be held liable in case they don't disclose the identity of the registrant.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Anybody else want to be in the queue? Well, if not, let me ask Steve Del Bianco to kind of walk us through his proposal. As you know, I had suggested there are four questions that need to be addressed, or it could be addressed in our subgroup, and Steve's proposal is very ambitious and addresses all four. So let me ask him to just give us a brief walkthrough of that, and then we'll open the floor to questions and comments.
Steve, it might be more productive to take questions and comments on each of the four questions in turn rather than go all the way through.
That'd be fine.
So
go ahead.
I tried to make three points with respect their qualifications and identification and verification. The implication that you have when you ask the question that way is that we are going to impose some obligations on the registrar who has to verify at the point at which the OPOC puts the information in. Is that correct?
Well, no. I was just listing some of the issues that could be addressed in these proposals. So it's I'm not making a supposition about what would be in there.
Okay. And nor are we making a supposition about who in the whole world has access to the information, because it's access to a separate group, or do we assume?
Right, we're assuming that if the OPOC proposal is implemented, then what people will, what the public will have access to is two things. First, the name and country of the registrant, name, province, and country of the registrant, and second, full contact details on the OPOC.
Right, so there's no debate that full contact details of the OPOC are part of the OPOC proposal.
Yes, I don't think there's any debate about that. I mean, when I say full, it's, you know, name, address, email, it's, telephone, and so forth.
Right, so if they're holding themselves out as being the operational point of contact, the first two items I put in here is that they have to have the technical capabilities, that's a knowledge bar, and then password protection, et cetera, so that they're able to get in and do it. So the first one says that they have to have the technical capability or have access to somebody who has the capability. That's under the assumption that the OPOC could well be an attorney or somebody holding themselves up as a legal front, a proxy. And while they themselves are not technically certified and have the passwords, they have access to somebody who can. Controversial. The second one's probably controversial because I said that they ought to have the capability to take a site down, because there may be situations where the action that's requested is to take a site down because it's generating denial of service attack, phishing email, spam, has illegal stolen music on it. And if those are the case, the OPOC can't very well turn around and say, well, I'm sorry, I don't have the capability. I'm not allowed to take the site down. That's somebody else. And if that were to happen, the OPOC at that point becomes a roadblock to a remedy. And then the final one is also controversial because it suggested that they be a legal agent and that they acknowledge that they have that role. And I think that Carlos made a fabulous distinction about 11A in suggesting that the proxy only incurs that liability if they fail to identify accurately and immediately the true registrant who has liability. Is that right, Carlos?
Yep, right.
And so that is a more subtle way to think of it, and I would be happy to accept that as a revision to my point about liability, since it reflects the status quo of the proxy policy already in place in the registrar accreditation agreement.
This is Eric. I would agree that if you combine those two and take out liability for the registrant's illegal activities, you simply assign liability for their inability to take down the site. I don't see any problem with the proxy being able to swear that he can and have an agreement that he can take down the site if need be. If you put those two together, then I think you solve the legal liability issue.
In any case, the OPOC would shed liability if they immediately and accurately identified the true registrant, so that liability could go to where it belongs.
Absolutely. That's a great idea.
Of course, we need standards for what immediately and accurately are, but yeah.
That's under the when question, right?
Hey, let me ask if there's people who want to comment on the who points that have been raised here, or the three points that Steve just walked through. Do we have anybody that wishes to comment on those?
I'd like to ask a question. This is Carlos.
Okay, Carlos, go ahead.
Steve, when you talk about the OPO being able to take the sites down, do you mean just that? I mean, just taking down the site as such, or do you also mean that the OPO should have any possibilities of removing illegal content, for example?
Steve, I think that was directed to you.
Yep.
Yes, I think what the remedy calls for a site that is generating phishing emails or spam,
it's one
thing. If there happens to be four illegal songs among a catalog of 50, you don't have to take the site down to remedy the situation. So I appreciate your distinction there, and that we probably, what I indicated was not that they have to take a site down, but that they have to have the ability to do so. I'm sensing, Carlos, that what you say is that they have to take technical capability and permission to remove illegal content from a site, and or if the situation calls for it, to take down a site.
Okay, thank you.
One other way to handle that.
Added to the queue?
Excuse me. Let's have a queue here. Who wanted to be in the queue?
Carol.
Okay, Carol, and who else?
Adam.
Adam. Anybody else? Carol, please go ahead.
Hi. I don't know if this would be a part of the who or the when. One of the things that comes to mind, we're talking about when they have the ability to take down a site. But quite often, from a policing perspective, sorry, that's the only perspective I have, when we're first asking for information, we're not necessarily asking for a site to be taken down. We're looking to do our preliminary background work to determine whether an offense has occurred or not. And I'm wondering if somewhere in this proposal there's an area where we could say that where police or law enforcement, it would be up to the group to define the elements of that, request information that the OPOC is not allowed to tell the registrant that the request has been made. Because if they do so, sometimes it will impede an investigation where, you know, the investigation could be something as simple as a commercial offense. Not that those are not serious, but it could also be part of an investigation where there are crimes against persons or physical offenses. And so if the OPOC notifies the registrant when the police is doing an investigation, that can have quite serious ramifications. So I'm just throwing that out as a thought for discussion.
Okay, thank you, Carol. That's a good point that we should discuss further. Adam, I think you were next.
Yeah, I'll kind of want to echo Carol. That's a really good point. That sometimes you want to know who's responsible so you can arrest them or whatever. You don't the site may be sort of secondary. My point was just to sort of add a little footnote onto the question of do you have to be able to take the site down or the content down or whatever. I mean, I think that to some degree, maybe all you need to do is, in that, in regard to that aspect, at a minimum, you need to be able to take the site down. And if the registrant wants to give the OPOC a more differentiated power to take particular pieces of content down, then that may be in the registrant's interest, because then if there's an issue, maybe the whole site doesn't come crashing down. But if in fail of that, then maybe what happens is that maybe there is a dispute only about, you know, one song on the site or one graphic or whatever, and if the registrant hasn't given the OPOC a more gradiated sort of degree of control on a practical level and authority on a legal level, then the OPOC has no choice but to take the whole site down, and that may solve the problem in those types of situations for the person who's complaining. But you know, the person who has lost out is the registrant, but it's their own fault for not having given greater degree of precise control to the OPOC.
Okay, I think, is there anybody else want to be in the queue?
Yeah, it's again Carlos, I'm sorry.
Carlos, go ahead.
I just wanted to sort of make a comment or ask Carol a question about what you just said with regards to the confidentiality with which OPOCs should sometimes handle, how do you call them, requests made from third parties to them with regards to illegal consent or illegal activities and tasks conducted to the website. Carol, isn't it possible in Canada to obligate OPOCs within the criminal process to keep silent, to remain confidential? It should not have to be something within ICANN policies to obligate OPOCs to remain, to keep such a confidentiality. I believe, at least according to the laws of many Latin American countries, it can be determined by the law enforcement authorities themselves, according to the procedures they have to handle in order to request someone to pass some information along to them. Do you understand my point?
I do, and quite frankly, it's going to depend on the circumstances. So, for example, if you'll grant me a moment just to go into it, a lot of the information, no, I take it back, all of the information currently on the WHOIS that is publicly available at this point in time is what we call pre-warrant information. That is to say that that is information that we would gather in an investigation at the beginning to later get a search warrant for things that are not publicly available right now, for example, the billing information and so on. So with that information, it depends on each country whether they have a law and to what degree that may or may not address it. However, in many countries, and I'm going to use Canada as an example because I'm familiar with that law, if we're doing pre-warrant information, therefore there is no court order in place, and again, this is the things that Subgroup B is dealing with, then you can't obligate that. You have to rely on the good faith of the person not to disclose that information unless it falls under a particular part of the privacy legislation, if that country has a privacy legislation. Because a lot of the investigations on the Internet span from one country to another, you may well have areas where there is no law that restricts that, and therefore you may have an investigation that is impeded or lost as a result of that disclosure occurring. So, you know, ICANN's rules aren't supposed to supersede any country's laws. However, we have to recognize that not everybody's system has matured to the same level, and there's still an obligation, I think, to make sure that the OPOC meets a certain standard but does not, on the other hand, enable certain activities. Now, under the Criminal Code of Canada, and again, I recognize everybody has a different one, there's a way that we can charge the OPOC if they make that disclosure, but that's after the fact and the harm's been done. Again, I only throw it out for discussion. I'm not saying it's a must-have, but it's certainly an issue of concern from a law enforcement police perspective. I hope that answers your question, Carlos.
Hey, Carol, this is Steve Del Bianco. And in fact, under the what, the second to last item under what is where we try to suggest what the responsibilities were of communicating something directly to the registrant. So your points are very applicable to that particular point when we get there.
Okay, let me ask if there's anybody else that wants to be in the queue on who. If not, I'll put myself in the queue just for a couple of comments. First of all, one thing we might want to spell out here, and maybe it's obvious, is that if the registered nameholder wants to list himself or herself as the OPOC, he or she may do so. Now, that person obviously has all the, you know, presumably has all the authorities that were talked about here, but there may be some people who want to list themselves as the OPOC. Second, we need to think about whether there's some standard on the relationship between the registered nameholder and the OPOC. For example, and perhaps some of this is dealt with later in your outline, Steve, we need to make sure that the since we're expecting that the OPOC will in some circumstances give up the or make public the contact information for the registered name holder, we need to make sure that the OPOC has that information and that it's kept current and or perhaps is verified. So that may be an obligation on the OPOC. And it also, I think, again, this may go without saying, there needs to be the registered name holder shouldn't be allowed to designate anybody as the OPOC without the OPOC's permission. So those are just a couple of other examples. And the final point I would make is I think one thing we need to keep in mind here is, and maybe more after we've gone through the whole list of questions, is that we need to be dealing both with what happens when there's a legitimate complaint that's raised, but we also need to be thinking about how do we prevent or deal with abuse, abusive requests, and how that should be handled.
This is Beth. May I get in the queue?
Yes, go ahead. And does anybody else want to be in the queue at this point?
Pat does.
Okay, Pat. Bertrand, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah. Sorry for the naive question. I'm putting two elements together here. What I heard earlier is that the full contact detail of the OPOC will be accessible to the public.
Yes.
What happens if an individual registering a domain name wants to be registered on his own behalf, doesn't want to use an OPOC,
mm-hmm.
Does that mean that he will be forced to register itself as an OPOC and then have its whole information revealed? I'm not sure I understand. Sorry again for the naive question, but I'm wondering whether we're not addressing two issues here that are different. One is the privacy protection of individuals and how much of this information is available and how confer subgroup B additional information is accessible. And the second element is the OPOC, which is in a certain way a sort of regulation of the present proxy services that seem to be not reliable enough. Am I mistaken or have I missed something?
Well, if I can respond, I guess I would say that if the registrant wants to list themselves as an OPOC, in effect it's kind of an opt-in situation in which they have decided that they do want to list this contact information on themselves.
Yes, but sorry to interrupt. This is exactly the point I'm a bit puzzled about. If I'm an individual domain name owner, at the moment I put information in the WHIS database that is public. Part of the discussion about the evolution of the WHIS service is precisely how to protect the privacy while at the same time making sure that access to this person is done when it is necessary. If in the new system I'm an individual and I don't want to designate a third party as an OPOC, what happens?
My suggestion is you can designate yourself as the OPOC if you wish.
Then my whole data is accessible, right?
Yes.
But so how? So the only way I can protect my data is to go through a third-party OPOC. Is that right?
Yes. I'm not sure I understand what the alternative would be. There would be nothing listed as an OPOC?
No, but this is my question. At the moment, the system is you register yourself and the whole data is accessible. You could very well imagine a system whereby you register your name and all the information. If you're an individual, only the few first lines like name and location in general terms is accessible, and there are additional rules for accessing what would be additional information. Does that mean that the system presently would force somebody who is registering as an individual to choose a third-party OPAC if this person wants to keep its own personal data private?
Yes.
Hmm. Okay. Sorry. This is something I didn't understand correctly.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And again, Bertrand, I'm not sure what the alternative would be. Either you list yourself, you list somebody else, or you list nothing. And nothing is certainly not an option under the OPAC proposal. So I'm not sure what the alternative would be.
No, it's not the question of listing. It's the question of accessing. I could list my information. If you take the present WHOIS database, the WHOIS database is maintained if the domain name has been registered through a given registrar. The information is available at the registrars, and you can imagine processes that designate or that go through that registrar under certain circumstances to have access to this information. Maybe the registrar is the OPOC by default, but at the moment there is an alternative that would be having your personal information that is only accessible in the superficial layers, to say so, and the additional information could be accessed, for instance, through the registrar, which has this information.
Well, I want to get farther in the queue, but I think one point you just raised is a very important one, which is what's the default situation? What if the registrant does not list an OPAC? You know, then what is access? What is accessible at that point? Let me ask Pat, who I think was next in the queue.
I can make a side comment to that question too, which is, in the United States at least, there's a concept of post office boxes, and so there's nothing that requires you to put your home address in the WHOIS data. It just has the contact data. The point I wanted to bring up though was, I think number one on who looks really good. I just have a quibble with some words. The technical capability and permissions to take down a registrant site, I think doesn't have a lot of meaning for a lot of what happens in the world, because there's also things like DOS attacks or malware being given out or stuff like that, where you don't really need to take down the site, you just may need to deal with the person's complaint. I don't exactly know how to say that, but I think it's more than just wiping out the site.
Okay. Thank you. And I think, I mean, we've raised a lot of issues here that Steve could take a look at, and I would encourage people to use the list to make some modifications to this, and that might well be an area where you think about a better way to say that.
So this is Steve Del Bianco. Is it okay to wrap this up and move into the next one?
Yes. Why don't we go ahead, because we're running low.
I wanted to quickly say that we don't have a question called, well, how much will it cost? But if we did, it would fit in right here, because Milton Mueller has written both to Steve Metallis and I and posted a public challenge to this proposal, suggesting that it would cost 10 orders of magnitude more than the current. And what we're suggesting here is that if you assume that a registrant wants to simply achieve privacy, well, then it should be very inexpensive to ask someone to stand in and be able to reach me. In the case of I only want privacy, but I'll make sure that my stand-in, my OPAC, my proxy, knows how to reach me, and he's going to make sure he knows how to reach me, because if he can't reach me, he assumes the liability. That is the status quo of a proxy registrant today. This statement that somehow our plan to impose liability will be expensive, it assumes that a registrant who wants not to get privacy, but rather to shift risk for illegal activity, to the OPAC. And you know, if that's what they seek to do, it should be expensive. If they only want privacy, the OPAC will know that they can reach them. And again, they have two choices. They can reach or reveal information when somebody wants to know who's the true registrant for purposes of tracking down illegal activity. So they may relay, or they may simply reveal. And if they relay or reveal accurately and quickly enough, they escape the liability. So their confidence in their ability to do that will keep the costs reasonable. The market will determine what those costs are. And frankly, people with a bad driving record pay a lot more for their insurance than people who have a good record. So we can move on to the what issue. But otherwise, Steve Metalis, you and I were both addressed by Milton Mueller about this cost issue, and yeah. I don't honestly.
Okay, why don't you go ahead on in the what points?
Right. So in the what, there's two categories of what. There's what has to be done at time of registration, and then what has to be done when Carol Bird calls up with a request. Right. Those are two different points in time. So all the time, the OFAC has to provide accurate and complete details for their own 24/7 contact info. I think that's a given, no controversy. Now, at time of registration, or when everything changes, I'm saying that the registrar has to validate the completeness and accuracy of the contact information provided. And I'm very sensitive about trying to impose any new obligations on registrars, so I'd really love to understand how to do this as easily as we can. The completeness is easy because the fields that the OPOC fills in are either filled in or they're not. There are validations that can be done on the address fields to know whether those are valid addresses. Those are easy and inexpensive. It's much more difficult to know if somebody's simply lying about their address. And I don't really know how to raise that accuracy standard to be sufficient for Carol Bird or the rest of them. What I've indicated here is that on the third item under two is that at the time of registration or whenever it changes, that the registrar should roll proxy contacts to the OPOC. This was a suggestion I got from someone else in the business constituency, and I think it's really a transitional item. In the case that a proxy contact is being used today, that proxy contact becomes the OPOC. That's my suggestion there. Now we go down to some other what they have to handle and not, and I'm suggesting they should not knowingly allow bad faith or illegal activity at the domain that they're responsible for. And I guess knowingly is the great escape clause for an OPOC who says, look, I didn't know. I wasn't checking to see if malware was coming from here or whether there were illegal songs and music and movies. So knowingly doesn't have any teeth in it, to be honest. Unless we, the law enforcement and corporate community, do a good job of telling them that there is illegal activity, and that's when obligations kick in. So they have to accept the contact of any nature, whether it's technical, administrative, IP, law enforcement, or legal notices, and they have to accept it on behalf of the registered names holder. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a business guy, so I don't know whether accept is the same thing as accepting process, and I need some help from the people on this call. We said that they have to receive and forward any communication to the registrant, although Carol was indicating that would be dangerous in the case where they don't want the registrant to know. The law enforcement is querying something about the site, so we'll have to fix that. Now, the OPOC can have this responsibility of making sure that they relay the message back from the registrant, which is a message of response to whatever illegal activity was cited. Or we could go to the current proxy system, where they have to simply reveal, instantly and accurately reveal, the private information about the registrant. I sense that will cause a lot of problems with privacy advocates, so we'll have to really understand that. It may be better for the OPOC to relay than reveal. But I'm open to evaluating those alternatives. And then I finally close by suggesting that they have to, if they informed of phishing or some attack that's generating commercial harm, that they have the responsibility to take the site down immediately upon proper notice. And if they didn't, they would be incurring contributory liability. And I'd be happy to shut up now and listen to questions.
Okay, let's open a queue on these points under what? Any comments?
Is Adam, can I get in the queue?
Adam, go ahead. Anybody else? Adam, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess just to respond to some of Steve's question about service of process and provide a little more information there. I think, you know, to some degree, the communication doesn't necessarily look any different from the point of view of what physically or electronically the OPOC is receiving. And this may actually sort of back up into the who category, perhaps, although, you know, I'm not sure we should worry about this sort of semantic difference, but that the purpose of service of process, or basically of any system that sets up a required legal notice to the person who you're bringing legal action against, is that it's an obligation on the part of the person who has to give that notice, and that can be satisfied when you can prove that it's actually achieved, or the person who was the recipient of the notice, I would think in most cases, could consent to, you know, saying, look, I agree not to challenge. If you notify me in this particular way, yes, I think it's reliable enough that I agree to, you know, treat that, you know, as if I was in fact actually notified. Now, by setting up the OPOC, we're setting up a system where the person who has the obligation to give that notice can't, by definition, actually say for certain that it's within their personal knowledge that the registrant actually received that notice. And so I think one of the places that this would come in would be that maybe who the OPOC is. The OPOC is someone who the registrant, the registered name holder, has consented to the validity of service upon them as being equivalent to service on the registered name holder.
Okay.
Can you add Carol to the queue, please?
And Chris.
Okay.
Steve, this is Steve DelBianco. Was that Eric who was just speaking about accepting process?
No, sorry, that was Adam Scoville.
Adam, could you put in writing and post that as a comment? Because I didn't capture enough of it to be able to make the edit.
Okay, I'll see what I can do.
Okay, we have Carol and Chris Gibson who's joined us. Anybody else in the queue? No, go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, it's a good question as to when somebody has to be notified of something, and I'm sure that there's a number of issues from a number of different perspectives on it. From a police perspective, it could be that we want the OPOC to notify the person because we think that the person is a victim. And so I think there has to be, if we're looking at it from a policing perspective, what we would be looking at is that the OPOC would not notify or pass on the communication to the registrant unless police indicated that it had no issues with it. Now, that comes with a whole bunch of different bits to it, and of course, we're back to the question of, is there a distinction between police and law enforcement in general, including private law enforcement? So that may well come with some liability issues for the OPOC if they do the notifications. So that's one of those things that has to be looked at.
Thank you. Chris?
Yeah, I think it's very important that any communication to the OPOC must be viewed as a valid communication to the registrant. It might be helpful to try to categorize notices just in two ways, those that pertain to administrative or technical matters on the one hand, and those that might be considered legal notices. And anything that falls in the category of legal notice, where there's any, I think there has to be specific responsibility for the OPOC to, you know, immediately 24/7 be passing these communications through to registrants. And I think from one of the previous speakers, the harder question is when are they not simply playing the role of immediately transmitting a communication through to the holder of the domain name, but when are they being required to actually disclose personal information and details about the domain name registrant.
Okay, so kind of drawing a distinction between when they're supposed to reveal and when they're supposed to relay.
Yeah, but I think on that relay and on that point of if a legal notice is sent to an OPOC, then it should be considered valid and sufficient to trigger all relevant time periods and any type of legal circumstances or proceedings. All of that must be at the point of contact with the OPOC and not waiting for this additional relay. And I think that has to be core to the responsibility of the OPOC.
Okay. Let me just put myself in the queue very briefly here just to remind all of us that, of course, since we're not writing a law here, and a lot of these things are questions of national law, there's a limit to the degree to which we can say, for example, you know, this will be valid service of process upon the registered name holder. That's obviously a local law question, whether or not the registered name holder has consented to it, and may or may not be determinative. And secondly, when we say they'll be contributorily liable, again, that's a national law question, so it's not as though ICANN in a contract can necessarily determine that. But I just want to put those caveats kind of on the table. We are running very short on time here, and I would like to get to when and how, and ask Steve Del Bianco just to move us quickly through those. And then I think we've raised a lot of good questions here, and I do hope people will use the list to try to refine this and come up with some new thoughts on this. But, Steve, could you just talk briefly about when, and then I'd also like, I know Eric had sent in something on when also.
All right, on when, what I had in here under when was the obligation of relay, and I put in, for sake of argument, within 12 hours of receipt, and that's relay. If reveal, as is the current proxy responsibility, were an option, then reveal should be immediate, and immediate might have a 1 hour. But relay would presumably be longer. Second thing I wrote is that they would have to investigate and take appropriate action, and I don't know the two legal standards for that, but without unreasonable delay would mean something in certain courts, or the words as soon as reasonably possible. I defer to the lawyers on the call to know what's better for that. And that is in response to notice of illegal activity. That's the takedown or the removing of files. And for that, putting in an absolute hour limit, I think, will be troublesome, because some things take longer than others. And I'll stop now.
Okay, and I think this is where Eric had suggested this 10-day approach.
Yeah, we're just generally speaking, with legal notices and legal documentation, is a 10-day approach to actual time to get something done. A guy's on vacation, mail takes too long to get there, whatever the case may be, his email's down. I think that we're running really short on the time, and I think we're going to have to extend it a little. I don't have any trouble with it because it's electronic, it being 12 hours, but I think we get into some probably problematic legal aspects, expecting someone to respond to something within 12 hours or within hours. That was my concern.
Okay. Well, I just would say, I think Steve seems to be drawing a distinction here between what the OPOC has to do, which is on a very short time frame in terms of forwarding and or revealing, but then, you know, in terms of what the registrant has to do, that obviously might take longer.
Right. The problem is that he takes a vacation. The OPOC takes a vacation. You know, we might have a 10-day delay.
Yeah.
And that, so that, reasonable, I think, is a very good way to put it.
This is Chris. I think you need to have a, at the OPOC level, I think your distinction is right, Steve, that the OPOC systems have to be pretty much 24/7 for purposes of relay and transmission to a registrant. I understand that the delays that can occur at the level of the registrant, whether they respond and how quickly they do so, but I think the OPOC in that role, it's going to be pretty tough if they are giving, more than, as we were saying, it's almost an hour or two to reveal. It should be that the transmission is an automatic function that takes place almost immediately.
Just to point this, Beth Holm, the relay function can be used when it's automated to just replace the capacity to contact in the existing WIS database. So there's at least a layer of automatic transmission of anything that is through email. Other possibilities of contact are different, but at least this one is an important one to introduce.
Yeah, this is Eric again. I bring to notice when we started up with the working group, how many people had auto reply mails coming back.
Right.
You know, that's just a situation. It's just a life. Sometimes people are out of the office. Sometimes people are unavailable to get a hold of. So, but
I'm not talking about the OPOC there. Because you can transfer automatically. One of the main reasons why individual users want to have their address fielded, especially their email address, is to avoid being spammed by harvesting. And so if you have a redirection that allows to send to the appropriate contact a mail that will be redirected, this is obviously an easy way to contact people if they are in good faith.
You're absolutely correct. That sounds very, very logical. I hadn't thought about that. They could just have it relayed to the registrant and not even reveal anything.
But, Steve DelBianca, when I said relay, you have to keep in mind that the OPOC will not want to simply relay all spam. So they may have some filtering that they will do upon relay.
Absolutely.
So making it immediate and automatic could actually be an issue. And when it comes to reveal, I doubt that the OPOC will instantly reveal to anyone who asks the personal contact information of the registrant that they are being paid to hide.
No, of course.
That there's going to be some validation that the OPOC will want to do,
yeah,
that the request deserves a response. And that's where we have to say that if you decide not to tell me their identity, that's the reveal, then you are stepping into the shoes of the registrant you're protecting for purposes of liability.
Yeah.
Can you add Carol into the queue, please?
Yeah, Carol, and who else? Did anybody else want to be in the queue?
Sorry, and Adam, please.
Carol, Adam, anybody else?
Yeah,
Bertrand.
Who's that? Bertrand?
Bertrand.
Okay, we're getting a lot of echo there, but go ahead, Carol.
I think I'm seeing some overlap between Work Group A and Work Group B. Work Group B is, for those of you that aren't in those discussions, talking about who should have access when, so therefore the reveal, if you will, part of it. And I think whatever that group, since that's their task, whatever they determine, will then flow naturally into, okay, once they've determined who gets what revealed to them, then you'll be in a better position to assess, okay, what are the timing implications of that? But it seems to me the reveal function falls under subgroup B. Have I misunderstood that?
No, I mean, I think there is some overlap between the assignments here. If the OPOC has a responsibility to reveal, then it's kind of in our bailiwick, but I agree there's a lot of overlap there.
Philip, can you clear up any of that?
I'm not sure Philip is still on the call.
Yes, I am, but I mean, comment is right. I mean, there is commonality between all three of the subgroups. No surprise there. We just try to carve things up to get things going in terms of listing options. I think it's useful to identify on each group where we see something naturally feeds into another group and just mark it as such, and indeed for the subgroup chairman to alert each other of that that circumstance so it can be factored into their work.
Okay. Let me. I think Adam is next in the queue.
I think Carol may have been ahead of me.
We've had Carol.
Okay. A couple of points. One, I think that we want to look at the question of how the medium of the communication ties into the standard for responsiveness. There's obviously this issue of email being automatically forwardable. I'm a little concerned, sort of in theory, the idea that the OPOC might filter for spam sounds, innocuous. I'm a little concerned with that being a big sort of loophole for the OPOC being able to say, well, I just thought this person who sent this letter, saying that this registrant had done all these things wrong, we get those kind of things all the time. That's pretty much spam, and seeing once you invest the OPOC with discretion to filter, I think that there'll be sometimes that'll be really clear that it's one or the other. An advertisement for, Viagra is probably not a legal notice. And on the other hand, a complaint that's filed in a court is probably not spam. But, at the margins, there's some room for that discretion sort of bogging down the effectiveness here. I think in terms of the distinction between what this subgroup is looking at and what the other subgroup is looking at, I think my understanding would be, and I don't know if this distinction works for anyone else, but that the other subgroup is sort of looking at, okay, just what you might have in terms of different levels of access on the sheer investigatory side, you know, before you've necessarily had to allege a specific wrong having happened, you know, say a member of law enforcement or an IP owner wants to go on and sort of just investigate who owns this domain name, that, you know, gives a lot of information to determine whether a wrong has been committed at all, and that group sort of, at that very initial level, that was the question that the other group had, you know, should there be different levels of access from the start? And the reveal function here seems more to go to the question of, you know, when there has been an actual allegation of legal wrong, and that's really a small subgroup of cases. You know, if I am, you know, going after a domain name that's been registered by one of our affiliates, and I don't have any intention of taking legal action, but want to sort of see some issues resolved, that may never implicate this this reveal function necessarily. And I certainly, it may be that I'd much rather not have to take, you know, to get into formal legal action. But the reveal function kicks in here, I think, under the normal OPOC scenario, once you're sending a substantive communication to the OPOC and to the registrant, that may kick in the reveal function, where the different levels of access, there may not be any communication that prompts that.
Well, this may help respond to the issue Carol's raised a couple of times, and maybe the inquiry by law enforcement that you don't want passed on to the registrant is a subgroup B issue, and the inquiry that you do want passed on to the registrant is a subgroup A issue. I think we had Bertrand in the queue.
Yeah, thank you. Just one quick point. I think it's important that we all keep in mind that there are actually two issues that are being addressed here. One is the treatment that is applied to people who just want privacy protection and the benefit of their national privacy protection law, irrespective of what they're doing or irrespective of any wrongdoing or good faith. The question that we're facing now with the WHOIS, and that is well mentioned in the GAC document, is that there are concerns today of incompatibility between the present regime and the national privacy law. So that's the first level. And in that case, what is needed is a way for people who want to access or to contact those people that are domain name holders the way they do it now on the WHOIS database for rightful purposes, not even legal action, but just because you're interested in this domain name and you want to contact those people, there's probably a subset of ways to go through automatic sending or not automatic sending, but there probably are ways where you can search the base online and, as an individual, send something to a hidden address. That's one point. The second point is completely different. It's the whole issue of handling the present proxy services that are basically people wanting anonymization for liability. This is completely different. These are two different elements, and I'm afraid that at the moment we're trying to address both at the same time. And the second point is that there is a distinction that was made that is very important, that we may be paying more attention, is the distinction between administrative and technical issues and the legal issues, and I agree there is a lot of overlap in the relationship that the subgroup
is. Okay. All right. Let me ask Steve if you could just very quickly take us through the how questions, and then we will need to wrap up.
And it's not how, but how would the responsibilities be enforced, i.e. what happens if they are not fulfilled? That's how the how was phrased.
Go ahead.
So the responsibilities have potentially reveal, knowing that was work group B's idea, and then relay, and relay is a two-way. I relay the query to the registrant, and then I must relay the registrant's response back to the requester. So there's two elements of relay. And then finally, there's responsibility to action, as we said earlier, that they have to be able to take a site down if we don't get a satisfactory response within the time frame we've set out. So what if they don't? They don't meet their defined responsibilities, reveal, relay, or remedy. I'm big on the R's today. then what has to happen? And I said there were four things here. So that they should immediately suspend the name records. That this is a responsibility on the registrar. Again, reluctant to do that. But a registrar would need to suspend the name records for the affected domain, and potentially suspend the web host service, because just shutting down a domain isn't sufficient if we have a lot of time to live delay, and a site continues to resolve for 24 to 48 hours, even though DNS is no longer live for them. I said that if you've failed to meet your responsibilities, then you have to immediately convey, this is the reveal, you have to reveal immediately. If you've been holding back for some reason on the reveal should kick in immediately at that remedy. Number three, the registry, in this case, should be notified to suspend website DNS. And again, there we have a 24 to 48 hour delay. And then also the registry should lock the domain so it can't simply be transferred. Where a bad actor can reopen immediately, transfers the domain, and is back in business. And I don't know for how long it should be held. I put a blank in there for how many days until the domain could be resold. I added something that somebody suggested is that the steps that are taken to resolve, the steps that are taken to enforce this, to suspend it, should not prejudice the party later on when they're appealing or seeking some alternative dispute resolution. And I'll stop.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure we have time to discuss these now, but I guess one reaction I have is that we need to be able to distinguish between a situation. Sometimes it won't be clear whether the problem is at the OPOC level or at the registrant level, I suppose. And I think a lot of these things are going to be very, they'll be detrimental to the registrant. But it may be that it was the OPOC that screwed up. So we need to kind of figure out how to reflect that in these remedies.
The OPOC is Registerfly, for instance.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Is there anybody that wanted to comment on these HAL points?
I just want to say a last comment. This is Carlos Alvarez.
Go ahead, Carlos.
Although I don't think we have much time, I just want to tell you all that I'm going to be sending a mail later on today pointing out some questions that I've been wondering about during this call. For example, we were all talking about roles and responsibilities of the old customer. What is the source of set roles and obligations of them, of their responsibilities? I mean, do the office, will they have to sign deals with the registrars, or will they have to sign deals only with the registrants? What's going to happen if an OPOC does not fulfill its obligations? Will their registrar have a chance to terminate a deal with that OPOC? What's going to happen with all the other registrants? Pointing out these questions, I don't think we have much time left, but I think those are issues we're going to have to think about.
Okay, Carlos, I think I would encourage you to send those questions to the list, the subgroup A list, and I think those are all good questions that need to be resolved. Unless there's anybody else in the queue, we've already gone way over, and I would like to wrap this up. Is there anybody else that wanted to speak? Okay, well, I want to thank Steve for being the sacrificial lamb here and putting this document forward. I think we've had a lot of good questions raised and refinements, and I would encourage people to use the list to suggest changes or raise questions. I don't know, Steve, if you can commit to trying to circulate a revised version or an updated version, let's say by Monday, in preparation for our call next Wednesday. Do you think that's doable?
Steve, I'm sorry. I will be on the West Coast all of next Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday giving some talks. So
okay.
I'll have to talk to you. I'll talk to you offline.
Okay. We'll figure that out offline. And I also would encourage people not only to bring questions or comments forward. If people have a different approach that they would like to these questions or one or more of them, please feel free to put that forward. But I think we've made a lot of progress today. So I'd like to thank everybody for their participation, and please do attend to the list. But I think we will also be reconvening again at the same time next week, next Wednesday.
Steve, this is Del Bianco. I would ask us all, if we've achieved four questions as a framework, and I would ask that within that framework, take a look at the actions of reveal and relay and then remedies, and so we can use a consistent vocabulary and structure to our plan.
All right. Any last comments? Okay, well, thank you, everybody, and thank you for sticking with us on our prolonged call here.
Thanks, Steve.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
All right.
Bye.